61,000 households in Anchorage have pets. That works out to about 105,000 dogs and 88,000 cats. That's a lot of animals and a lot of animal waste. And pet ownership doesn't just impact the people who live with creatures. Caring for pets is both challenging and rewarding for veterinarians and their staff, too. This week on Hometown Alaska, we're talking to veterinarians about their mental health and pet care basics, as well as taking a trip to the dog park to see how your actions affect everyone downstream. I'm your host, Ann Hillman. Let's start the conversation with two longtime Alaska vets.
My name is Dr. Tracy Ward. I'm a veterinarian in Juneau. I've been in practice for 32 years. I have worked in food animal practice, mixed animal. I was in the pharmaceutical industry for a number of years doing clinical research. And since I've lived in Juneau, I have been a practitioner at a companion animal veterinary practice. And then most recently, I moved to the local animal shelter here. And I'm currently the shelter veterinarian at Juneau Animal Rescue.
And I am Dr. Judy Montalbano. I've been a veterinarian. I guess I just realized my 30-year graduation anniversary is coming up. I've been a small animal veterinarian predominantly, but done some large animal work, a little bit of captive wildlife work. And about 2 years ago, I transitioned from the general practice world to teaching at Matanuska-Sitna College, their veterinary assisting program.
Well, congratulations on your 30-year anniversary. That's really impressive. Oh. Dr. Montalbano, so many kids in my life are like, I love animals. I want to be a vet. When people say that to you, how do you describe what you do and what your life is like?
Wow, that's a tough one. You know, I guess when I talk to students, especially, I will say veterinary medicine has tons and tons of challenges and tons of triumphs. But I would put in a nutshell, the one thing I can honestly say about my career is I can't remember ever having what I would call a boring or dull day in my whole career. It's always interesting and always something new. So you go from in the morning seeing a puppy shot to an old animal with cancer to maybe in the afternoon you might see an emu or a llama. It's an incredibly varied career.
How about you, Dr. Ward?
I would have to agree with never a dull moment. sometimes you're wishing it would be boring and it rarely happens. The thing that I always make sure I emphasize to folks who say, you know, well, I really love animals or I want to be a veterinarian because I love animals. I always like to remind folks that any animal you're going to see as a veterinarian does have a person attached to them in some capacity, right? Cows have farmers and dogs and cats have pet owners. And you have to really love people as well. The veterinarians that I know who have at times struggled emotionally with the difficulties of veterinary practice, a lot of times it's the people stress, not the animal stress for us. And so it is important to remember that this is very much a profession that deals with human beings as well as animals.
I feel like I hear so frequently that within the veterinary profession, mental health is a major issue, and it's kind of a crisis within your profession. Would either of you feel comfortable talking a bit more about that?
Yeah, it really is amazing that I don't know any veterinarian in my circle of friends that hasn't been touched by a colleague's suicide in some way. Somebody they know, somebody they used to work with. And it isn't always the veterinarians. I mean, what the veterinary technicians are in that situation as well. And I think as a general personality trait, the people who go into veterinary medicine are going in there because they love the animals and they face difficulties communicating with the human on the other end of the leash or, you know, carrier, cat carrier or whatever. Those people, when you are going into it because of a love of animals, you may or may not have grown up bonding very well with people. You also have a idea in your head of what is the absolute best way to care for animals. And sometimes that comes in direct conflict with what the owner feels. The owner may either just not have the financial resources, not have the personal resources otherwise to take care of a sick pet in the fashion that you would wish that they would. And the profession selects people who would do anything on the planet to make this animal well. Not everybody has that same valuation of animals in their life. So these create a ton of conflict.
Dr. Ward, would you like to add anything?
I agree with a lot of pretty much everything Dr. Montalbano said. I think another difficulty for me, definitely, and having moved to the shelter medicine side of things, is that people's expectations for medical care are not always in alliance with their ability to pay for that. And unfortunately, there aren't the social safety nets for animals that there are for humans. And veterinarians, private practitioners are a business. They're a small business. And so being able to, the expectation of being able to offer payment plans or do a lot of things for free is not a reasonable expectation, but it's one that many people in the public have. And I think every veterinarian I know has at some point been accused of only caring about money when they wouldn't treat someone's animal for free. And that is very stressful, very emotional to be told, the whole reason that you are here is because you care about animals, and to be told that you don't care is very hard for many of us. And we often, do the best we can, but at some point we're a business. We have to pay our bills. We have to pay our employees. And so that, I think, is a really stressful part of being a veterinarian and a practice owner, is that we're not just there to be a doctor. We have to take into account the financial aspects of it. And that is a hard conversation to have for many of us. There are a lot of things. I mean, I'm not trying to make being a veterinarian, sound awful. It's extremely rewarding, but there are certainly aspects of it that are difficult emotionally.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense that with the happy emotions come really hard emotions.
Absolutely agree with what Tracy said. And I've been in that same boat, and I term it emotional whiplash. When you go from that euthanasia and you're choking back tears and trying to do a good job by the animal, and then somebody in the next room over is, tapping their foot because you're running a few minutes behind. And then you come in and you're not bright and cheery and bubbly because you've got this kind of emotional hangover from the previous exam room you were in. It's a hard thing to transition your emotions with no gap in between.
You're both board members of a state association for veterinarians. Within that association, are you all focusing on mental health and supporting others within your profession?
That's something we discuss frequently. It's something that we actually have a presentation. Our annual meeting is coming up in October. We have a conference every fall for veterinarians and veterinary technicians in Alaska. And one of our keynote speakers in the upcoming conference is going to be talking about mental health and about how veterinarians can help each other cope. And we certainly have had in past years as well, we've had discussions and presentations to our veterinarians, which is one way that we are, trying to help veterinarians deal with some of the difficulties. There's currently a fairly significant shortage of licensed veterinary technicians, which are basically the equivalent of a nurse. So obviously doctors need nurses, veterinarians need technicians for support. There's quite a shortage of veterinarians and licensed veterinary technicians in Alaska. We have been advocating for measures to help alleviate some of those difficulties and barriers to getting veterinarians licensed, getting technicians licensed. So it's kind of a multifactorial, the board of the larger organization, the Alaska State Veterinary Medical Association, are trying to help address some of those issues from a number of different angles.
Why is there such a shortage of both vets and vet techs in Alaska?
Wow, I'm not sure we have all the answers to that, but there's lots and lots of factors. Yes, there's a shortage in Alaska, but there's actually a shortage worldwide. It's not even just the United States, but worldwide. You have a certain, shall I say, graying of the veterinary population. So there are a number of veterinarians who are the baby boomers who are retiring. Those people who are retiring are folks that often were, I guess the culture of veterinary medicine when I graduated, probably Tracy too, was You worked long hours. You know, a 40-hour week was sort of a sissy week. My first job, I was working 60 to 70 hours a week. So it didn't take as many veterinarians to see all the patients if you were working 60 or 70 hours a week. And more veterinarians now are realizing some of the importance of the work-life balance and not working themselves as hard as we did, perhaps, when we were first graduating. So that plays into it. But also the number of pets that are out there has risen phenomenally. I think the statistics, and this is based on COVID adoptions and whatnot, the number of pets per veterinarian in the United States to be seen went up by 1,000 pets per veterinarian over I've forgotten the maybe Tracy remembers the number of or what was the time frame for that. But essentially that would break down to a full-time veterinarian needing to potentially see another 2 or 3 patients a day. And we were already busy before that. And technicians, a lot of the statistics on veterinary technicians leaving the profession, I think the average vet tech longevity from the time that they start in the profession to the time that they leave the profession for other things is only, I think, 4 to 7 years, which is kind of abysmal why they're leaving the profession. Of course, there's a lot of different reasons, but the pay, they're in a job that is the equivalent of being a veterinary version of an RN, but also at the same time, they also are dental hygienists, lab technicians, x-ray technicians, surgical technicians, nurse anesthetists, and I'm sure I'm missing other aspects of a veterinary technician. So they do it all. And they make a fraction of what an RN or a dental hygienist makes. So a number of these people, they have a love for medicine, they have a love for animals, but when it comes down to getting a paycheck, a lot of them are ending up going back to school to go into the human medical fields so that they can make more money and someday retire.
And so they're leaving the field after like 7 years, even though it takes multiple years to get that degree, doesn't it?
Forgotten the statistic, but I think it's actually...
I think it's five.
Four or five years, yeah. Something like that. I think seven is a pretty tenured veterinary technician. So trying to make sure that the vet techs are supported as well and have clients understand the incredible value that those people are to caring for your pets. You know, veterinarians, we're making the diagnoses and prescribing the treatments, but it's the technicians that are performing a lot of those treatments other than surgery, of course.
Yeah, sorry, to answer your question, it takes 2 years in a licensed veterinary technician program. So a lot of people are only, you know, they're spending 2 years in school to become a licensed technician and leaving after only 4 or 5.
We've talked a little bit about like what people within the profession are doing to make it, I guess, easier and to support one another. What can your patients do? What can pet owners and animal owners do to help support both vets and vet techs?
I tell all my students a couple of bits of advice. One is, you want to be the nicest client you possibly can be to to the receptionists at the clinic. The receptionists get an incredible amount of abuse from people. And you know what? They're talking to the vets about you when you have been a complaining person. So if you're a super nice client, they will try to work you into the schedule as much as possible. So be the considerate client, be understanding to every member of the veterinary team, not just the doctor or the technician, but every member of the team. You should probably think very carefully about considering getting pet insurance so that you can actually, without question, afford to do what your pet needs. That pet insurance can really help streamline some of those questions about can I afford to do it? And plan ahead. The ones that, if you have somebody who hasn't established a good rapport with a vet clinic, and it sounds mean, but you're not as high on their priority list as their well-established clients. So don't be a procrastinator and forget that you need a health certificate to travel with your pet until the day before your flight takes off or even the same day, things like that. I don't know, Tracy, any other ideas?
It's almost like, you know, we feel like coming to the veterinary clinic is a service industry, like a coffee shop or, you know, a grocery store, as opposed to, you know, a medical facility. And if you the best clients that I have are the people that are understanding when I come in a room 5 minutes or 10 minutes late and say, you know, I'm really sorry that I'm running behind. I had a, you know, very difficult, or we had an emergency. We had a dog hit by a car come into the back. And if you would want, you know, to your pet to be prioritized in an emergency situation, be understanding when you need to be rescheduled, or your veterinarian is maybe not quite 100% focused on the current situation, because you, at any given point in time, we're juggling, you know, 3 to 5 patients in other rooms or in the back of the clinic in the treatment area. So I think just kind of trying to assume the best instead of assume the worst about the cost of services, the timing, you know, if it's difficult to get an appointment at your vet clinic, it's not because they're sitting around, you know, playing cards in the back. It's because they're busy and they're working hard, and, you know, they have to prioritize and triage cases.
Do you still recommend that people take their dogs and cats in for like the annual well visit? Like, are those necessary?
That's a really good question. I mean, the short answer is yes, because preventive care is a much more cost-effective thing, and many more health benefits to the animal than kind of taking the, he's doing well, so he doesn't need to go to the veterinarian. You know, things like vaccines, wellness checkups, where the veterinarian might detect something that's just getting started that you might not notice. Because remember, animals are very good at hiding their illness, right? We often don't see many situations until the animal's been experiencing some degree of change or illness for a significant period of time. And so early detection of diseases and prevention of diseases by keeping up on vaccinations, by appropriate deworming for senior pets, you know, annual blood work to detect if some sort of disease is starting up, you know, early when it's still in the manageable stages. So you might have to wait 2 or 3 weeks to get one of those wellness appointments instead of being able to book it the next day. But that doesn't mean that they shouldn't happen.
That is good to know. And for things like shots, if you have a strictly indoor pet, do they still need to get shots like your cat?
Yes. Well, certainly rabies is a state law. That is a requirement by state law that you have to have your pets rabies vaccinated. And even from a practical standpoint, you may say, well, he's going to stay home all the time. But you may have visitors to your house that could get bitten. You may have to unexpectedly board them if you have to fly out of state for some emergency. There's just any number of reasons, as well as, of course, escape from your house happens. With all of our best intentions, our animals do occasionally get out. So rabies is a requirement. And then some of these diseases can be carried in by you, or simply you take your dog for a walk on a public trail and another animal has it. Parvovirus is a canine disease that we have in the state, well, all over the United States, and it's extremely stable in the soil for long periods of time after an animal's deposited feces there. I actually knew a lady whose puppy Chihuahua was unvaccinated because it was a strictly indoor pet. It had never set foot outdoors on the ground ever in its life, and it was not vaccinated. It still caught parvovirus. We don't know how. Probably she tracked it in on her shoes, and the puppy may have chewed on her shoes. There's just so many ways. So yes, even indoor pets, but it's a conversation you should have with your veterinarian as far as what are your individual animal's risks. That's a good conversation to have with your vet. What are your individual pet's risk factors for disease?
In terms of risk factors, are there things that you advise every pet owner to keep at home, like a pet first aid kit in case there's an emergency or they sense something's wrong?
That's a tough one. At home, not as much. I guess when I counsel people, it was oftentimes when you're more remote, because most areas, there is some 24-hour access to a veterinarian at a clinic or even to be able to run to the drugstore for an antihistamine or something like that. If you had, say, a remote cabin and you were taking your pet out there,
or you were backpacking or something,
discuss with your vet what to have in your emergency kit, because that will depend on whether it's a dog, it's a cat. You could get some dosing for some of these over-the-counter drugs, you know, some basic bandage material recommendations. I know the clinic I was at, there were a few people who asked us that question, and we helped them design a personalized emergency kit There is a website that has a list of sort of emergency stuff to have on hand for your pet, in more for natural disasters, not so much patching them up medically as making sure you have food, water, a collar, leash, maybe a toy or two, a few like personal care items for emergencies, like we would have an earthquake kit or something like that, but what to have for your pet.
I would add the most important thing I think people should have handy, or they know it, is the number for the SPCA's pet poison control line. I direct people to call that number all the time, because we get phone calls about, you know, my cat just ate this, or my dog just was exposed to this. I mean, veterinarians, we probably have a better understanding of what can be poisonous and what can't, but we don't know, you know, the exact amount of exposure or species of lily or dose of chocolate that's toxic right off the top of our heads. But the SPCA has a poison control hotline that's available 24/7, and they can very easily calculate for you, you know, tell me approximately what your pet weighs, read me the label of what they got into, and they can advise you very quickly if that's a toxin, if it's a toxin in the first place, if the, you know, what level of danger, should you go straight to an emergency clinic, should you try to make your pet vomit at home. That's probably the most useful thing people could keep somewhere handy.
Absolutely.
Thanks. That's great advice. We will post that number to our website. Yeah, unless you all know it off the top of your head.
I actually have it if you want it.
Please.
My phone.
It's 888-426-4435.
Thank you. Are there other things that sometimes even really attentive pet owners sometimes neglect with their animals, things that you'd call attention to for them?
Toenail trims. and sometimes matted hair, especially certain breeds are notorious for forming hair mats, and that can be very uncomfortable for them. I equate it to like when your mom would braid your hair and she'd get one or two hairs pulling wrong. It just hurt, and the dog can't do anything about it, or your cat neglecting to get their puppy or kitten vaccines on time.
One of the big concerns that I see very frequently is overweight pets. I think a huge part of preventive medicine is keeping your pet at a healthy weight, especially, you know, cats. And those two things often combine. If you have an overweight cat, especially a cat with long hair, and they literally can't reach around to groom themselves properly, then they're very prone to developing some severe matting. You know, we do medical shave downs on a regular basis for cats, for, you know, that literally are so overweight they can't reach their backside and their flanks to groom themselves. So paying attention to your pet's diet is as important as it is paying attention to your own.
But what is it, Tracy? Something like 40% or more of pets in the United States are overweight or obese. And yes, that is a huge, so many things play into that as they get older, arthritis problems, inability to get around, diabetes development, any number of things. If you want to do one thing to keep your pet healthy, and there are certainly more things you should do, like vaccination and all, but as they age, keeping them in an ideal body weight. There was even a study of longevity in dogs that showed significant improvement in lifespan with just maintaining their weight at optimal body weight.
And how do you know the optimal body weight for your pet? You talk to your vet.
Talk to your vet. There are these things called body condition scoring. Since body mass index is sort of a human thing, it doesn't really apply because we're, you know, dogs come in so many different sizes and shapes, and cats and things, so all animals. But there's the equivalent is what we call body condition scoring. And you can look online and find body condition scoring guidelines for dogs, cats, which of course for the shaggier, hairier breeds involves using your fingers, not just your eyeballs. You have to actually feel landmarks, but mainly talking to your veterinarian and getting weight estimates on, you know, weighing the pet regularly at the veterinarian, and then getting them or a technician to give you a ballpark of where should that animal be.
Thank you both so much for all of this advice and just knowledge about the profession. Before we wrap up, are there any sort of last things you want people to think about if they're considering getting a pet or they have a pet?
That could be another whole show.
Yeah,
but certainly my main consideration would be to, especially with dogs, to make sure that you understand the breed of dog that you're getting, and that you have the time and the experience. There are breeds that are, you know, easy. There are breeds that are harder. There are breeds that are high energy and breeds that are couch potatoes. And some of the biggest behavior situations and most unfortunate things that I see at the shelter are dogs that are relinquished because of behavior issues or socialization issues. And it really, 95% of the time, it's not the dog's fault. It's that they aren't in an appropriate situation. They're not getting enough exercise. They weren't properly socialized as a puppy, or they're simply, not what the person who got them was expecting them to be.
I agree. And research the breed carefully, because some breeds are known for being more expensive, not to purchase necessarily, although that can be, but to maintain them. And if you're getting a pet on a shoestring budget, there's some breeds that are almost guaranteed to be more expensive healthcare-wise to take care of. And getting a pet, like Tracy said, it's a two-way street. Not only is this the right pet for me, but am I the right owner for that pet? Because if you are a couch potato who likes to sit around watching television, there are some breeds of dogs that are going to absolutely hate that. They are high energy. They need to be out there working, running, doing things all the time. And you're just going to create a stir crazy pet.
Well, thank you both very much for your time. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Judy Montalbano and Dr. Tracy Ward talking about life as a vet and basics for caring for your pets. I'm Ann Hellman. You're listening to Hometown Alaska on Alaska Public Media. We'll be back in a moment with more ways you can keep your pets and everyone else's healthy. Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. I'm Ann Hillman. Today we're talking about pets, vets, and cleaning up dog poop. I headed down to University Lake Dog Park with Anchorage Waterways Council Executive Director Sherry Northen a few days ago to find out why picking up after your pet is about more than just aesthetics and smell.
If you could just point out all the poop that you see while we're walking. Okay, there's two, three.
Are we going to tally?
So today we are walking around University Lake Dog Park. And talking about dog poop, why is dog poop a big issue?
Well, there are various levels of concern about it. I guess the health concern is probably the biggest. When animal poop, pet waste, is not picked up, it all runs down into the nearest waterway. We're all in a great watershed. Everybody's in a watershed. And anything that's on the ground washes down. It goes into the lake here, or it'll go into a creek eventually. When you have breakup, you've had precipitation, stormwater runoff carries it all downhill. And once it's in the water, it carries bacteria that is harmful to humans and pets.
So in the 1 minute that we've been walking, I've counted probably 8 piles of dog poop.
Yes, I did too.
But they're all biodegrading, so if they're just gonna break down, is it still a problem?
Yes, they are full of bacteria, E. coli bacteria. That is, if you've ever had Giardia, people call it beaver fever, diarrhea, nausea. That's one of the main problems of picking it up if you're in water. And even getting splashed, you can pick it up. There was a lot of concern about in the early 80s, fishermen being out, we had a lot of raw sewage in the local creeks, and the fact that people might get splashed picking up a fish or anything like that was so concerning because of the bacteria they could pick up that they actually closed off and stopped some of the fishing and activities. You know, we're talking just splashes.
So, like, looking around here and the quantity of dog poop that's at this park,
yeah.
Does that mean, like, if you were to get splashed by, say, your dog who's playing in University Lake, you'd be at risk?
Yeah, in a way. It's not, people, it's probably not as bad here as far as people water contact. Dogs can get ill from it, though. That's another concern. But in the creeks, we have the same runoff going into creeks because the trails along through the green belts, all the any poop left along them like this runs down into the local creeks. And Campbell Creek is a big rafting, kayaking, tubing creek. Up at Lake Otis, at the park, you find kids swimming in it, their faces in it, and they're splashing their toddlers in it. And yeah, that's not good for anybody's health.
And so it's like, is it the problem that there's just so many dogs and so much poop, or is it any little amount can affect it?
You know, that's a good question. In the municipality, it's estimated there are about 65,000 dogs, and that's the whole municipality. And that's not based on counts or licensing. Looking at the urban areas, the size of them, of the population, there are formulas to come out with kind of an expected number of dogs for that kind of population and land size. And we figure each dog poops about 3/4 of a pound poop a day. You know, not even a pound. But you multiply 65,000 times 0.75 pounds, and it's ends up being about 20 tons every day on the ground. And we know not everybody picks up. So in the congested areas or the high-use areas like the park here, that means a lot of poop ends up in the water. And drinking water standards are pretty much what they use for determining if a creek is impaired. So every creek and the lakes in Anchorage, except for a few lakes, have what's known as a fecal coliform impairment. They don't meet EPA standards, which means 20 fecal coliform bacteria colonies per 10 milliliters of water. And so to get out of that impairment, you've got to have really, really clean water. So it doesn't take a lot of poop to come up with, you know, 20 colonies of bacteria in 10 milliliters of water. It's a really, really difficult status to get away from.
So just to review, most of the lakes and the creeks in Anchorage have this bacteria in them.
Oh gosh, yeah. Yeah, because they're at the bottom of this watershed. The creeks are the bottom of the watershed. The lakes, as you can see, it's all running down here. You've got the trails around University Lake. The poop's up here. It's melting, or it rains, goes right downhill into the lake or into a creek because they're all downhill.
And so is there anything to, like, can anything be done to stop this from happening other than just picking up poop?
Not that I know of. Picking it up, you know, you got to eliminate it at the source. That's really where it starts.
Okay, so let's talk about the source, people's dogs. People love their dogs.
Yep.
Is there, if you see someone not notice that their dog has pooped and doesn't, or just see someone ignoring it, that it's there, how do you have that conversation about maybe you should pick up your dog poop?
Well, there are different approaches. We prefer people to be cordial about it and assume that the person may not have seen it, or they may not know they have to pick it up, or may not think about it. So what we suggest is people carry a couple extra bags, which I always seem to have them in my pockets, and you can just politely say, oh, excuse me, you know, I bet you forgot your bag, or maybe you forgot your bag, or I'll give you a bag, you notice your dog just went to the bathroom over there. And they'll react accordingly. Some will say, you know, get miffed and walk away. Some will look chagrined and make it maybe walk away. And some may go and pick it up, which is what we hope that they will do.
And if they just look miffed and walk away, do you just...
You can't do anything about it. You can fume about it. And, you know, and some people kind of get into sort of a challenging, you know, a vocal battle or something with them, but, you know, you don't want it to turn into a confrontation.
Is it legally required that you pick up your dog's poop?
Yes. It's in the municipal code, Title 17. And if you leave pet waste on the ground and don't pick it up, and one of the animal control officers sees you, or a citizen could document you doing this by your car license number, you might know the person, and you can file a complaint with the animal control. And there's a fine, starts at $50 and goes up. Dealing actually had two calls yesterday about poop, and one fellow we're trying to work with in a condo association where one of the tenants is taking his dogs to poop right at the edge of the parking lot and the head of a trail that goes down to Campbell Creek. So the person who contacted me doesn't want a confrontation with him, but, you know, it's a sensitive thing, so we're trying to work with a condo association to address it. But every situation's different.
Would you advise people to talk to others and be like, hey, it's a health concern for your dog and my dog?
Certainly. Or your toddler. You know, if you have a little one walking along here and they step in these nice puddles of, we call poop soup, and then you toddle back to the car, and the child gets in its car seat and it's got it on its boots, the dog's got it on its feet, then they're on the seat of your car, then they get home and maybe it's not all off and they track it in the house. You know, take the baby's boots off, but you don't take the paws off, and it's around in a variety of places.
So what happens if your dog does something like my dog likes to do and poops in a place that you just can't access? Like yesterday, it was on the edge of the lake down an icy slope and the ice is thin. So my solution was, okay, I can't reach my dog's poop, but I can pick up these other three piles of
poop.
Yes,
and that's a really good solution. I mean, there are times when you can't get it. And I, you know, obviously you have a concern about it and felt like you had to do something, so you picked up after three other dogs. And, you know, there are just times you're not going to be able to do it, so don't beat yourself up. But try to pick up some others. And if you are picking up yours and there's a pile by, grab it as well. You know, be the do-gooder in all this.
I always think of it as making sure you have good poop karma.
Yeah, poop karma. I like that.
Okay, what about if you're backpacking with your dog and you're like way off in the mountains and you're not in an area that it's concentrated like here? Should you pack out your poop?
We recommend it. You would pack out your poop, right?
Well, some people bury it.
Okay, then you can bury the dog's poop as well. We've created some little containers. They're little zip containers, and I have a friend who's using them. She backpacks all the time. It's sealed. I think they're dope bags because you can't smell them. You know, they conceal smells. So anyway, we put some little bags in there, and she packs it out with her, picks it up in a plastic bag, sticks it up there in the bag, zips it. She knows it's not going to leak or smell or anything. And that's one of the problems, like in the dog parks, people pick it up, put it in a bag and leave it because they don't want to walk with it. They don't want it banging on their pants or their, you know, they don't want it in the kid's stroller or the backpack. So we're trying to find methods to give people a way to pack things out or carry it a distance. It's one of our bigger problems. And just because it's in a bag does not mean it's not going to be a problem, because eventually the bag will break down. Then you've got plastic, you've got the pet waste, you know, it doesn't go away, and it's not fertilizer.
So the solution we usually do is, like, we use old plastic bags that have zip tops, some, like, dried fruit or whatever, and then put the bags inside of those bags.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's a really good idea. So you've created your own to do it.
Yeah. And then we make the dog carry it out.
Yeah, and you can do that. You can tie it to the leash, you can tie it to the dog's pack or anything. But why not? Why not clean it up? I mean, it's not going to be as critical as an urban area, but still, you know, you're cleaning up some stuff that could be nasty out there.
But out, like, if you think about being out in the wilderness, there's all these animals and you don't pick up their poop, like there's bears and moose.
And we get that even in Anchorage. We get that as an argument all the time. Moose, bears, you're not out there picking up their poop. No, but they don't eat the kind of diets our dogs do. They're not carnivores. They're not eating meat. You know, while moose, you break down the pellets and it's basically sawdust. They do have some E. coli in them, but it's not of the bacteria types that we're concerned with for humans. And, you know, in Anchorage, if you think 65,000 dogs and, I don't know, 400 moose, it's not the same thing. So, yeah.
So if you're picking up your poop, you're putting it in the trash and it all goes to the landfill, right? Mm-hmm.
Is that a problem to have this massive concentration of dog poop in the landfill?
Well, you've got a lot of other noxious things in there, and that's, we, you know, nobody likes to have a landfill or have to have one, but it's one of the best places. In the dog parks, we have the trash cans around here, the plastic trash cans, all the poop bags go in there, and other trash, they all go to the landfill. And a landfill is a kind of a necessary evil of urban areas. But yeah, it's in there, but they're supposed to be lined and they're not supposed to leach things out because there's things much more deleterious than bacteria from poop.
What about all the plastic created by all the dog poop bags? Is that a problem?
Some of them are biodegradable or compostable, but they're still maybe put into a larger plastic bag again, a bit larger trash bag, and that's not going to break down. So yeah, I mean, plastic is something we were trying to do reasonably, you know, get away from, but we can't. I mean, it's a trade-off. You just can't have everything perfect. So, you know, health of the dog, your family, yourself, and other animals, we just think that that's preferable to some of the other necessarily ills of plastic. Don't drink water out of plastic bottles. Do your part to offset it, you know.
What else really surprises people about this issue?
I think the number of dogs and how much pet waste can end up. We have a poster that illustrates the 20 or 40 tons, whatever it is. I mean, it's like the size of a blue whale every day. You've got to put it into some visual. And so they think, well, it's just my dog and my little dog and my little poop. But it's cumulative, you know. It's the bigger picture. And it's like, well, if I leave it, it's not going to be a big problem. But it is. And the next person leaves it. You know, It's frustrating. We never know how well we're doing. When I walk along Campbell Creek Trail where I live and drop a bag in the trash bin, it's nice when I see, first of all, I'll see several poops along the walk.
And you then, pick them up?
No, I tried in the wintertime, and if they're frozen, I can't. I don't carry a shovel or anything with me, which is why we have Scoop the Poop Day, with people get out there and shovel this stuff up. But when I get to the trash can, and I was thinking about this yesterday, and I look in, and I see a bunch of dog poop bags in there. I know there are a lot of people picking up, you know, and that's heartening that they're doing it. And then there were probably four poops along the trail. But that's on the trails. We have another issue because a lot of people, and you've been seeing this play out in the newspaper, people on bikes on the trails, because their dog is not attached to them. So now I'm on the trail, my dog is leashed, and I know exactly what she does, and she's within reach. When you're riding a bike, the dog's either way ahead of you, or it's way behind you, or same if you're jogging or skiing. The dog's off a leash and you don't see every minute and you're focused on what you're doing. You know, you don't know when the dog suddenly decides to poop if it's 50 feet behind you. And there are a lot of people whose dogs are on leashes and they don't pick it up.
Anything else you'd like to add?
Please just scoop the poop. We do our annual April Scoop the Poop Day. It's more of an awareness thing. We go to a couple dog parks and you see all the bags of poop that have been picked up. But just make every day a Scoop the Poop Day. You know, it's good for you. It's good for the waterways, the critters in the water, you know, the fish, birds, everything, your family. And, you know, it's just a whole lot nicer if you pick up.
Well, thank you so much.
Sure. Thanks. We would just love to talk about this subject.
That was Sherry Northen talking about the environmental impacts of dog poop. I'm Ann Hillman. This is Hometown Alaska on Alaska Public Media. We'll have links and more information on the Hometown Alaska webpage. Do you have an idea for a show? Send us an email to hometown@alaskapublic.org. We'd love to hear from you.
From Alaska Public Media, this is State of Art. Welcome to State of Art on Hometown Alaska, your weekly dose of Anchorage arts and culture. I'm Ammon Swenson. Coming up, we'll hear about Cyrano's upcoming production of Dog Park, a play examining friendship and everything that comes along with it. But first, artist Erin Gingrich opened a show for First Friday at APU's ConocoPhillips Gallery. She's a Koyukon, Athabascan, and Inupiaq interdisciplinary artist, and in English, her show is called Red Silver Dreams. It'll be on display through May. Gingrich and gallery manager James Tempty joined me to discuss the show. Gingrich says art wasn't her first choice when going to school.
My first choice was wildlife biology, which then kind of translated into art making. And of course, now I make, you know, representations of our wild relatives and wild beings. So it totally worked in my favor.
Yeah, totally. What would you say is maybe like the driving force behind your art?
I make representations of the wild resources that feed us and historically have fed my ancestors and my family. And I make those to honor these wild beings that keep us here in the north, right? Like these resources have kept my ancestors and my family here for, you know, since time immemorial, you know, salmon, berries, our seals, like all of these beautiful things that give us resources in order to survive here with this beautiful land we call home.
Yeah. And are there any other maybe things that you do that you were taught from maybe like your grandmother or something like that? You mentioned the beadwork. Is there anything else that you kind of continue the tradition through your own artwork?
An important part of what I call the research for my work is continuing to have a subsistence practice in some way. So I go back to Nome and I pick berries with my elders. I go to fish camp and I try to, you know, spend time with the river and assist my family in taking care of the gifts of salmon we receive when we're there. Those practices really support my work and help me build a deeper relationship to these resources.
Yeah, totally. I mean, what do you get out of, you know, going out and, you know, doing a harvest or, you know, fishing or something, kind of reconnecting? What do you get out of that?
It's about getting to be able to be present as well as to visit these beautiful resources and receive these gifts that have been cared for and sustained through ancient relationships that, you know, the indigenous peoples of Alaska have worked very hard to build and maintain. Like, these resources are here because they were cared for and they were, you know, intentionally part of systems of care that existed long before me.
Yeah. I mean, how important is maybe the future to your work?
I think that that's an interesting question. I've never been asked that before. I think that the future is a part of it because I'm trying to assist in maintaining these systems of care and reciprocity that allow us to continue to be here, that allow us to continue to live in place and in relation to these things. And my hope is that my work helps, you know, assists the work that is done by a lot of others to protect and maintain these wild resources that we have.
Well, tell me about this upcoming show. If I'm not mistaken, I see it's going to be like carving and photographic work from the 2022 fishing season. Could you say the name of the show for me and maybe kind of talk about, you know, some of the significance of that work that you did, I guess?
So the title is Kavyaksak Kavyaktak Sengnaktut. And that translates to Red Silver Dreams, and that's Inupiaq. And my attempt to translate that, I'm still a language learner, so it could be imperfect, but I make that decision to show up with my language as much as I can. And so this work is about the things that arrived to me from the river last year, because those things have sustained me over the winter, and the fishing season from last year was a really good one for me. And for me, that means like a whole bunch of salmon. And some of that salmon is our salmon that I photographed on the banks of the Ksiloff River. Some of the salmon I photographed while my family and I were working on taking care of it and processing it. But it's also carved work that represents those salmon, the carved work that has been in connection to that specific resource. And that's all work I made last year because I had a lot of opportunity last year to make new work. And I wanted to just bring all of that sustenance together from the river.
James, so what did you see in Erin's work that, you know, made you want to feature her in the gallery?
Yeah, Erin's work, I love that it's connected to the land, it's connected to place, it's connected to traditions. And when I first saw it, I thought it was really powerful how she then uses traditional carving but incorporates beadwork and just this really ornate, beautiful way. And I was like, you know, at APU, we have a lot of Alaska Native students, and for them to see an artist featuring and talking about, you know, something that's very precious to them, I thought that would just kind of make them feel at home. And, you know, it'd be just a wonderful way to celebrate our students, but also honor and feature an artist. And it's part of a Siri Foundation program, the Journey to what matters. And so with that, we got a small grant to support and feature Alaska Native artists that make tangible works of art. And so Aaron was a great fit for that. And I love that program because it actually provides resources for us to, you know, provide honorariums for artists. And I think that's the direction that, you know, like, I think as someone who manages a gallery that we're looking to go is, I think so often artists, you know, they create the work and then they take time out of their day to drop it off and to hang the shows. And then they're not really supported financially until they sell a piece. And so we're looking at, you know, this could be the start, and the Siri Foundation is funding it to, like, let's provide honorariums for them just to show.
Yeah, put the focus a little bit more on them. They're the ones creating. I mean, the gallery does a lot of work, but in the end, it's just kind of a venue, right?
Yeah. A university, you know, we're really looking to share information and share experiences that we can all kind of learn from. And Erin's a great fit because her work is, you know, it shares like a way of life and values of the Inupiaq and of her and her family.
That was artist Aaron Gingrich and APU gallery manager James Tempty. Gingrich's show, Red Silver Dreams, will be on display at the APU ConocoPhillips Gallery through May. Up next, Cyrano's Theater Company's upcoming production is called Dog Park and follows the friendship between two women and everything that comes with it. Director Jill Bess and one of the play's leads, Gigi Lynch, joined me to talk about the show and the group's close friendships on and off the stage.
It started off as a reading at the Valdez Theater Conference, which Lisa Konopliski, the writer, and Gigi Lynch and I, we've all gone to for years, where we all became very good friends. And we've been wanting to get Lisa's work out to the world. And this is the first one. I mean, she has other plays, tons of other plays. This is the one that we together, this group of women, worked together so that we could make sure it got produced.
Yeah. What was maybe so attractive about this specific play?
You want to talk to that, Gigi?
Oh, goodness. I think we all fell in love with it when we first heard it down in Valdez. And it was, I wouldn't say quite a bit different, but there was a lot of scenes cut, a lot of new scenes added, some things turned around. And with every script that we saw that Lisa produced, it just kept getting better and better and better. And we fell in love with these characters. They're just so real. I mean, they're real women, and it's such a beautiful commentary on two women who are so opposite each other, who, despite that, come together and then are put in circumstances that, you know, were unexpected, and how they both come to grips with it and what happens with the friendship as a result.
Was it maybe kind of a collaborative process to get where we are today and ultimately for the premiere?
Oh, yeah.
Very much so.
You know, well, Jill and Lisa go way back. Do you even want to talk about that, Jill?
Oh, well, Lisa and I met at a Meisner training program back in 2012. We studied for 2 summers together and became fast friends. And I encouraged her to start sending her scripts up to the Valdez Theater Conference, and she did. And they started getting accepted, and she became a regular. And it was wonderful because we sort of had this annual place that we could connect. I remember when Lisa and I met each other, it was one of those things. And actually, Gigi and I had this same experience where you meet someone and you say, I want to get to know this person. Maybe there's a little bit of that, Gigi, in the script, you know, like, you know, and because yeah. Gigi and I had the same experience. But I know that this came out of a frustration. You know, it's tough being a playwright. There are so many playwrights, so many really good playwrights, and it's very difficult to get your work done. And we were all sitting around commiserating about how tough it is. And, you know, I think we just all kind of said, well, then let's just make this happen. And I will just say it is, you know, you're talking about collaboration. This is one of those experiences. I know Gigi will agree with me on this. It is a magic group of people, of women in particular. And it's like every day coming in to that rehearsal with these women, it's such a place of trust. And it's all about that very thing in the script. You know, it's we really are building on all our friendships here. So there's lots of magic to it. I will say that. It's a ride. It's a roller coaster ride.
Yeah, well, it sounds like maybe one of the key ingredients was genuine friendship putting this thing together.
I would say so. Absolutely.
Let's see. So, Jill, what's it been like? It kind of sounds like all the pieces just kind of came together in a good way. So I guess what's the experience been like to direct this? It must be, are you even working? Or are you just sitting there having a good time with your friends?
That's a great question. You know, I'm going to share just a little bit here. I lost my parents over the winter, in the past few months, and it was really tough. And I honestly didn't know if I was like, I don't know if I can do this. I don't know if I can direct this show. And I went to them, and they were all so loving and so giving, and I couldn't have done this with a different group. I hope I make the place a safe place for them, but they have made it a safe place for me as mm-hmm. well. And so there have been one or two times where I've said, you know what, I can't be at rehearsal tomorrow because I've got to go take care of all these, you know, these issues, or I just need a day where I can kind of pull it together. And so it's been an emotional ride for me, mm-hmm. but it's been a magic place to be during a very difficult time. And these women have been like each other's cheerleader. I am not exaggerating when I say this has been a gift.
Well, you know, what are some of your favorite aspects of this play? It seems like it could go either way, kind of behind the scenes, just getting stuff ready, working out little details with some friends, or like, you know, actually rehearsing and putting the thing on, or, you know, it sounds like it could be just kind of the whole gamut seems like it's been enjoyable.
It has been. I will say I'm also doing costumes for the play.
Oh.
And when we first thought about this, we were like, oh, this is going to be easy. You know, three of us. And I wasn't thinking at the time. I was like, yeah, I mean, we're just at a dog park with our dogs. I mean, obviously you never see the dogs, but, you know, they're there. And so I said, sure, I'll do costumes. And then I realized there was 16 changes of clothes, everybody, and went, So, and they're lightning fast changes, like 15 to 30 seconds. So that has been a bit of a challenge. It has been a lot of times with, you know, with plays, you'll have, you know, long scenes that go on, and then you'll have a scene change here, and pieces are being moved around on the set, and people have time backstage to change and, you know, touch up their makeup and come back out, and none of that.
You are on stage the entire show.
Well,
right?
Except for like 15 seconds.
Oh, yeah, 15. Yeah. Like you get about 15 seconds off stage. That's right. Yeah.
Is there anything else you'd want to add to let people know about this show?
You know, there is one other thing I want to say, because we struggled with this a little bit when we were creating the publicity for it. And the sense was, this looks like a comedy. Let's bring the kids and go see a show about dogs. And it's not. It is about friendship. And it has some very light moments that are so fun. And you will definitely be giggling and laughing and having a good time. But then it deals with some heavy subject matter. And so just I want the audience to be aware that Dog Park is where it takes place. But it's about these women. And it's a very realistic piece of theater. So bring a few, you know, tissues. But expect to have a good laugh, too. So.
Sounds like bring a friend, too.
Oh, yes. That's a great idea. Yeah.
That was Jill Bess and Gigi Lynch from Cyrano's upcoming production, Dog Park. It opens May 12th and runs through the 28th. And that's all for State of Art. I'm Ammon Swenson.
Thanks to Drs. Tracy Ward, Judy Montalbano, and Sherry Northen for your help with today's program, which was produced by Ammon Swenson. Find us on the web at alaskapublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Ann Hellman. Thanks for listening and for taking care of and picking up after your pets.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.